First, I want to thank the J.B. Moore Society and the University of Virginia for sponsoring this symposium. 30 years ago, when I was a student here, I enjoyed the opportunity to participate in these type of events. We had to be very careful back then to schedule them around our hectic whitewater rafting schedule and football games and basketball games. But nevertheless, we succeeded, and I did enjoy participating in them. And I enjoy coming back to Charlottesville and participating in this event today. I can't think of, frankly, a more pressing or important topic than the topic of democracy in the Middle East. I want to thank all the panelists this morning, and I'm looking forward to attending the panels this afternoon. I'm going to introduce now Dr. Peter Ackerman, who is the chairman of Freedom House, and he is going to speak on how freedom is won, which many of the second-year and third-year law students attending this may think deals with making partner at a major law firm. But it doesn't. Dr. Ackerman is a leading authority on nonviolent conflict. He is the founding chair of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict in D.C., and he serves on the Council of Foreign Relations and the Board of CARE. He has produced PBS documentaries bringing down a dictator, which is on the table over there, which deals with the fall of Slobodan Milosevic. And he has also produced A Force More Powerful, which charts civilian-based resistance, such as Gandhi's movement, the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, dismantling apartheid in South Africa, and the fall of the Pinochet regime in Chile. He is quoted often and publishes in major magazines around the world. Sometimes he doesn't quite get it right, worried lately about, I think, the tenor of things in the Middle East. He did contact a Danish publisher and said perhaps we ought to try to lighten the mood a bit by humor, so it doesn't always work. But he does his best, and I think we'll find his talk very informative. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simon. I want to thank Professor Moore, my colleague on the Freedom House Board, for having me here, and for Justin and his team for making me and my wife, Joanne, feel so comfortable. You know, a lot of people say to you in speeches who come here, say, well, I'm really glad to be here, and that's sort of the polite thing to do, but I am really glad to be here, and I have some special credentials to say why. Because 41 years ago, I was born in Queens, New York, and I was going to public high school. And they had a draconian system which allowed you only to apply to three colleges and three colleges only. So I decided that if I was going to apply to three colleges, I sure as heck wanted to go see the colleges I applied to and make sure I liked the place I was considering going, since I had only three shots to fire. And so 41 years ago, I came here because this is one of the three schools I applied to. And I was staggered by the beauty of the place, the solidity of it, and would have been delighted to have come. I was accepted here as I was at Penn, but I ultimately went to Colgate because, like Madame Bovary, I went to the school that wanted me the most, and it turned out to have been Colgate at the time. But in my mind's eye for the last 40 years, I've always had this vision of UVA, and I haven't come back. And so I was very interested this morning. I got in very late last night to come in and drive around and with my wife Joanne and just sort of see if that vision has still been confirmed. And this place is gorgeous. It's obviously wealthier than it was before. I mean, the new buildings since I've been here are obvious. They're staggering. They're consistent with the beauty of the place. And frankly, I'm amazed. And I think you all who are here should feel tremendously lucky to be here. Now, I thought maybe, in keeping with what you had said, it might be interesting to try a humorous introduction to what I consider to be a very serious topic. But I was almost dissuaded from doing this last night because I was invited to dinner, and I had a very lovely dinner with some of the young students, and we went through the early courses of the dinner talking about all the obligatory political and international relations issues. And then when dessert came, we shifted to the topic of movies, and somebody said, well, what is your favorite comedy? And I said, a fish called Wanda, and they looked at me totally blankly, and I said, oh, my God. But I see there's some people of, let's say, who are a little bit older that are dispersed with the group, so I want to ask you, how many of you remember Johnny Carson? For those who might not, that was the guy who preceded Jay Leno for 30 years. But if you remember, he had this skit he would do where he would put on a turban and a cape and claim that he was the great Karnak with mystical powers. And then what he would do is, to prove those mystical powers, he would take an envelope, and the envelope had a question. And without opening the envelope, he would give the answer to the question. Then he would open the envelope and give you the question. So we would go, Yogi Berra. Then he would open up the envelope and say, who said when you reach a fork in the road, take it? And that would be Yogi Berra. So here it is, my tribe. So nonviolent civic resistance movements. So if I open up the envelope, the question that would be asked is, what has been the most significant factor in driving countries from dictatorship to democracy since the last time Peter Ackerman came to UVA? And the answer is nonviolent civic resistance movements. In your little packet here, you have a piece that was done by the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict and by Freedom House called How Freedom Is Won. And what we did is we looked at, as our base of data, of 67 countries that have made transitions to democracy in the last, really, 3.5 decades. And I'm going to talk about a series of conclusions later on, but let me give you the first one as a teaser, and that is that of the 67 transitions, and these are of countries that are at least have made the transition at least for 2 years, and of these 67, only 17 involved elite-to-elite transfers of power, some kind of negotiated transfer of power. 50 involved nonviolent, bottoms-up, civic resistance movements designed to disrupt the status quo. And that data impelled the rest of the study, which I'm going to talk about, some of the conclusions which I'll talk about at the end of my talk, which I think are very compelling. But let me start by answering the question, what is civic resistance or nonviolent conflict? And that is what people do when they are living under conditions of oppression but have absolutely no viable military option to deal with it. And we are not talking about what we are talking about is conditions that are far more intense than normal parliamentary disputes. And in each of these conflicts, people undertook disruptive acts as sanctions, as aggressive measures to constrain or punish opponents and to win concessions. Protests such as petitions, parades, walkouts, and demonstrations were used to rouse public support and mobilization. Forms of non-cooperation such as strikes, boycotts, resignations, and civil disobedience helped subvert the operations of government. And direct interventions such as sit-ins and blockades frustrated many rulers' capabilities to subjugate their own people. The cumulative historic result here was massive. Tyrants over the last century have been toppled. Governments were overthrown. Occupying armies were impeded. And political systems that withheld human rights were shattered. Entire societies were transformed by people using nonviolent resistance to destroy their opponent's ability to steer events. And here are some examples over the last century. It all really began in Russia when an Orthodox priest, Georgi Gapon, persuaded 150,000 workers to walk the icy streets of St. Petersburg in the century's first public challenge to autocratic power. He ignited mass action that led to the country's first popularly elected national parliament. After World War I imposed reparations on Germany, miners and railway workers in the Ruhr in 1923 confronted invading French and Belgian soldiers who were sent to extract German coal resources. They refused to cooperate and thwarted the invaders' goals until the British and Americans pressed for the troops' withdrawal. In 1930 and 31, Mohandas Gandhi led mass civil disobedience against the British in India. He convinced his followers to stop paying salt taxes and buying cloth and liquor monopolized by the British, thereby intensifying their long, successful drive to independence. Danish citizens during the German occupation in World War II refused to aid Nazi war effort and brought their cities to a standstill, forcing the Germans to end curfews and blockades. Other European people under Nazi domination resisted with similar tactics. Salvadoran students and doctors and merchants, fed up with the brutality imposed on their country by a military dictator, organized a civic strike in 1944, Without picking up a single gun, they detached the general from his closest supporters, including members of the military, and forced him into exile. Less than 10 years after the British left India, a Baptist preacher from Georgia, the Reverend Martin Luther King, following Gandhi's teachings, led his fellow African Americans on a 15-year campaign of marches and boycotts to overthrow racial segregation in the American South. A few years after Dr. King was assassinated, Polish dissidents, in what I would argue was the pivotal moment of a century of nonviolent conflict, defied communist rule by initiating new forms of resistance rarely seen in the Soviet bloc. Beginning with a momentous strike in this city, in Gdansk, workers won the right to organize a free trade union, giving rise to solidarity and eventually the end of communism. As a change was brewing in Poland, a group of Argentine mothers, outraged by their government's silence about the disappearance of their sons, started marching on the central plaza of Buenos Aires. They did not stop until the legitimacy of the country's military junta was undermined, leading to its downfall after the debacle of the Falklands War. Half a world away, Ferdinand Marcos stole an election in the Philippines in 1986. Corazon Aquino, the widow of an assassinated opposition leader, led hundreds of thousands into the streets. Supporting a rebellion by reform-minded military officers, they stopped the dictator from holding power by force, and he was forced to flee the country. Not long after the Filipinos reclaimed their democracy, Palestinians challenged Israeli presence in the West Bank by organizing protests and boycotts and by building their own network of social services. This wave of nonviolent resistance became the least visible part of the First Intifada. While solidarity continued its struggle under martial law, boycott organizers, trade unions, and religious leaders in South Africa joined to wage a nonviolent campaign against apartheid. Along with international sanctions, they eventually forced the freeing of Nelson Mandela and negotiations for a democratic future. And recently, in 1999 to 2000, a student-led resistance movement in Serbia and a unified political opposition mobilized the defeat of Slobodan Milosevic at the polls. With his security force neutralized by a nonviolent uprising and facing a general strike, the Butcher of the Balkans capitulated. Now, 5 years into the 21st century, a new record is being made in the events in Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, and Lebanon. Now, when I started working on this subject in the early 1970s, many of these cases didn't exist. Yet I was impressed by two common factors that carry through even today. The first is that tyrants, no matter how brutal, are far more vulnerable than people assume, because even they have pillars of support that are necessary for them to stay in power. And what I'm thinking about here is the business community, the bureaucracy, and most importantly, the loyalty of the security services and the military. And then second, when civic opposition movements plan their strategy for battle thoroughly, the chance for victory improves dramatically. Now, in my 30 years with this subject, many people are very skeptical when I say this, particularly when we try to claim the possibilities for regime transformation in current trouble spots, for example, Iran, Belarus, Zimbabwe, and Cuba. At the same time, I can tell you of countless cases of successful nonviolent resistance movements that left the experts totally baffled. I would invite you to read the pundits on Poland, South Africa, Chile, Serbia, and Ukraine as a year before their transformations, and they would never have predicted what actually did occur. Now, why is this disconnect with us? And the answer is that people have trouble seeing how nonviolence can overthrow a brutal dictator. And frankly, expressed that way, I can see their point, because the wording itself is confusing. Nonviolence is generally thought of as an ethical choice, undertaken as a matter of personal principle, and usually undertaken by pacifists. Historically, tyrants, authoritarians, have very little to fear from them. But nonviolent conflict that subsumes the kinds of tactics I described before, nonviolent but extremely disruptive, has been designed to undermine the legitimacy of their opponents. And it's worth noting, frankly, that most leaders of winning civic resistance movements would have resorted to violence if they believed it would work. Many of them came to using nonviolent strategies because they had just a recent experience with unsuccessful violent insurrections. That's what happened in Poland, for example. That's what happened in South Africa. In Poland, there was what happened in the streets in Warsaw in 1970, and that led to a whole theoretical movement about the virtues of civic resistance as a next step to deal with communist rule. what you had, if you remember, in South Africa, if you had Biko in the 70s and all the violence that occurred then, and a whole new group of civics organizations grew up in the mid-1980s that were far more devastating to white apartheid rule. Seen this way, in other words, the distinction between nonviolent conflict and nonviolence, nonviolence being a noun, nonviolent conflict being an adjective that subsumes a variety of these tactics, we can then begin to understand that nonviolent conflict really is best understood as a contest, the outcome of which is determined much less by one's moral position and much more by strategic planning. My mentor on this subject, the one who got me involved 30 years ago, is a man named Thomas Schelling, who you might remember just received the Nobel Prize for Economics. He was a game theorist who did much to basically create the framework for understanding how we needed to interact with the Soviets during the Cold War period, and particularly the nuclear threat that we represented to each other. The whole concept of mutually assured destruction was really a concept based on his work. But 45 years ago, he wrote the following, which I think is proven very, very true today. This is what he said about nonviolent conflict. He said, "The tyrant and his subjects are in somewhat symmetrical positions. They can deny him most of what he wants. They can, that is, if they have the disciplined organization to refuse collaboration. And he can deny them just about everything they want. He can deny it by using the force at his command. They can deny him the satisfaction of ruling a disciplined country. He can deny them the satisfaction of ruling themselves. They can confront him with chaos, starvation, idleness, and social breakdown. But he confronts them with the same thing, and indeed, most of what they deny him, they deny themselves. It is a bargaining situation in which either side, if adequately disciplined and organized, can deny most of what the other wants, and it remains to see who wins." Now, this question, "it remains to see who wins," has informed a lot of my writing over the last 30 years. It was informed my dissertation, and in 1994, I co-authored a book called Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, and what I did is I looked at six cases of nonviolent resistance movements. I compared them and tried to distill from them what came to be 12 principles that I felt were determinative as to why nonviolent resistance movements succeeded or failed. And this was an effort I had dreamed of undertaking for many years. From the time I did my dissertation, I became an investment banker, God knows why, in between. Then in 1994, published this book. And the sad part about all of it is that when I published the book, it was published by Prager, and there's 5,000 copies were produced. I had to give 2,000 away to my best friends before I would sell out. And I was pretty discouraged because I felt what I had to say was really quite important, but obviously nobody was really listening. Then about a year later, a fellow named Steve York came to see me, who was a documentary producer, an exceptional one. And he said, "I read your book." And I said, "Ah, an endangered species." And he said, no, I really think the stories you tell, the cases you tell, would make great documentary material. And I'd like to do a documentary on it. And I said, really, for about a half year, leave me alone. I was so discouraged. But after a while, we talked some more. And I said, "Look, if you can do through the documentary, your documentary artistry, what I couldn't do with my pen, which is to take these cases and show that despite the fact they happened in many different parts of the world and in many different decades, they're essentially the same story, which is how nonviolent movements undermine these pillars of support that an authoritarian needs to stay in power, then I'm in." We got a little planning grant from the U.S. Institute of Peace. We basically took that over as credibility to WETA, which is one of the sponsoring public broadcasting stations. And in September of 2000, we put on two 90-minute segments on public broadcasting. And what we did is we covered six stories: the Indian independence movement, the Nashville lunch counter boycotts, the anti-apartheid movement, the Danish resistance to the Nazis, the Solidarity movement, and the anti-Pinochet movement. And the movie was called A Force More Powerful. Now, that movie was seen by 3 million Americans. And then, very interestingly, 1 month after the movie was shown, Slobodan Milosevic obliged us with the first great success of nonviolent resistance in the new millennium, because in October of 2000, he basically said, "I have to step down because I need to spend more time with my grandchildren." We immediately went to We immediately went to Belgrade and visited with the opposition. And what we did then was basically show them one of our stories, which was the fall of Pinochet, which was a 29-minute segment. And very interestingly, what they said to us, you know, they watched it. It ended. There was silence for a while. And they said, you know, had we seen this movie 4 years ago, we would have known what to do a lot sooner. There never would have been a war in Kosovo. And, you know, there was some regret. What we did then is create another documentary called Bringing Down a Dictator. And that basically appeared on PBS in Easter of 2002. Now, what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, and I think you'll enjoy it, is I have two short segments from the Pinochet segment of A Force More Powerful and Bringing Down a Dictator. I'd like to show them to you now, and then I'll have some closing remarks. Okay. Let me see if I can pull this back. Is this blocking anybody's view here? Okay.
perform a parallel vote count based on sampling techniques. By fax and telephone, the numbers are vetted at Pinos in Santiago. By early evening, they project a no as one decisive win. A small independent radio station announces the results. Ensconced in the presidential palace, Pinochet says nothing. Suspicions of electoral fraud grow as hours pass with no announcement of the vote tally. At midnight, Pinochet's Navy, Air Force and police commanders enter the palace. General Fernando Mattei, Air Force commander, tells reporters, "It appears that no has won." A public statement that warns Pinochet to accept the defeat. Within seconds, his remarks are on the radio.
The great thing was that it didn't really come from ordinary, extraordinary people. And they really did put their lives on the line, and they really did come up, and they really were willing to take a stand.
I think that we are in the world we really live on power. And what we would like to is to live on authority, personal authority, moral authority. When you act based on power, but if I have a gun pointed at me, I'm going to say whatever you think and you want. If you take your gun off my head, I will do what I want. We used to how people lived at that moment. And they lived without hatred, convinced that they had been the participants, the actors, aquí no hubo líderes. Here there was no charismatic leader, no guerrilla, no vanguard that would say, I did this. The sense in Chile that night was that they had done it themselves. How many? 7 million.
Or presents itself as a national movement. we did everything right. We are a massive movement. We made a congress like, I don't know, we covered whole Serbia. And then after the congress, we did cover whole Serbia. We, I don't know, said we are a people's movement, although we were just a bunch of students. But after that, we became a people's movement, and everyone came to us.
Elections are still at least a year away. In the meantime, OPCOR builds its network, using other weapons to undermine Milosevic. Recruiting and training hundreds of grassroots activists, OPCOR has no national leader or central committee. Belgrade sends supplies, but local OPCOR activists run their own affairs. It's a conscious strategy, which will keep the local resistance going, even if the Belgrade leadership is arrested.
They were afraid of us. They wanted to portray us as terrorists, as fascists, and as, I don't know, criminals, drug addicts, and something like that. But when people go out in the street, they see members of resistance. They see that these kids are like 18 to 20 years of age. I'm one of the older members, like I'm 26, 27 now. And they say, come on, this is ridiculous. These kids are not fascists. These kids are just kids.
Since these two movies have been on PBS, they've been translated into 9 languages, and they've been shown in over 60 countries by, we think, over an excess of 10 million people. In one case, they turned out to be a training tool for the Rose Revolution, where they had learned of the movie. They had called us up and said, could we get a Georgian translation? And we said, well, here, take a movie and you translate it. And they did, and they showed it in small meetings around the country and through independent TV. And what happened as a result of all, and in addition, as a result of all this, is opposition groups from around the world came to us and said, we saw what happened here. This speaks to our situation. We have tremendous ferment and upset in our country, but we don't know what to do next. And one of the reasons we created the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, because it was quite clear that the real lack was not the ability to exert power. The real lack was to have the confidence to know what to do next, to have the strategic vision that would basically allow them to go forward with a reasonable level of risk and confidence. Now, what we're about to do next, in sort of meeting the demand from these opposition groups, is we're about to do another movie that's going to appear, which is on the Orange Revolution, which will be in, I think, movie theaters in the middle of the year. And it tells exactly the same story. What you saw with Chile is the end of the Chilean story was not when the plebiscite happened. The end of the Chilean story was when General Mate said, it's over. Because right then he walked into a meeting and Pinochet said, well, let's forget about this and let's basically have martial law. And basically he protected his whole military group at the top by saying publicly that Pinochet had already lost, so that he could basically say to Pinochet in that meeting, we're not doing it. And we have wonderful scenes in the Milosevic movie of military standing down again and again and again and unwilling to basically confront the protesters in those fateful days just before Milosevic stepped down. The two movies, we have copies for everyone for the Milosevic movie. It's 55 minutes. What I tell my friends, and said, if you're thinking of turning on Desperate Housewives, don't watch this movie. It'll be as equally entertaining. It'll be very moving, and it won the Peabody Award. And it's I think it has most of the ingredients that I think are critical to understand why I think authoritarians are, as I said before, quite a bit more vulnerable than they appear when they're in power. Now the question, this is my concluding comments, why does this, and I'll take some questions if you like, why does all this matter? Well, in this Freedom House study that we included here in your packet, basically looked at 67 transitions to democracy over the last 32 years. Now Freedom House is a very unusual organization because, as you may know, they actually rank every country every year according to one metric of freedom. And they're the only ones who have been doing it for the last three decades. So what that creates is a body of data that's unique in this sense, is that you could actually measure changes in levels of freedom over periods of time for every country. Of course, there's one country that there's been no change in level of freedom that's been flatlined at the lowest score possible for the last 32 years, and that's, of course, North Korea. But there's been considerable movement with other countries over time. And what we wanted to ask ourselves the question is there behavior before transition to democracy that basically correlates with levels of freedom after a transition to democracy? And here are two important findings that we had amongst the others that are in there. The first is that there was an extraordinary correlation between levels of violence and levels of freedom. If you had high levels of violence by the opposition before a transition to democracy, you would end up with low levels of freedom afterwards. Low levels of violence by the opposition, high levels of freedom. And most interestingly, in addition, it did not matter whether the regime was brutal or benign. Their levels of violence had no correlation either way with levels of freedom afterwards. The point being, it mattered how the opposition behaved. And if they were committed to nonviolent tactics and nonviolent discipline, the end result was going to end up to be quite a bit better than if they were willing to basically intersperse their movement with violent insurrection tactics. The second finding was that there was an extraordinarily even higher correlation between the level of participation in society in these civic movements and levels of freedom. So to the extent all levels of society participated, old people, young people, men, women, people of higher economic and lower economic stratas, and they all came together around the central issue of who is going to govern them and who is going to basically, what their destiny was going to be in terms of the kind of society we're going to have. To the extent that there was a high level of participation, there was extraordinarily high levels of freedom afterwards, an extraordinary correlation, the highest correlation that we had in the study. So what is this, when you put this all together, what this means is, what it really means is it stands on the head, the model that I had when I was graduating in 1968 from Colgate, which was the romantic notion about the violent insurrectionist. So the idea, you know, so the old ugly American notion, well, you go out and you find 5,000 highly athletic males, you arm them, they drive a wedge between, you know, through the security services, kill the guy at the top, and now you have a friendly guy who's in power. Well, there's all sorts of problems with that model. First is that it very rarely occurs and is very rarely successful. And when it is successful, it has unpredictable results. In fact, it doesn't lead to democracy at all. So when we talk about nonviolent civic resistance movements, whether I'm the great Carnac or I'm just here talking to you as an individual who studied this for quite some time, how you wage your struggle, your commitment to nonviolent discipline, your willingness to disrupt but maintain that nonviolent discipline will drive the level of freedom you have after a movement is successful. So I'll stop here and take any questions anybody would like to ask.